Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the wonderful Anna Crilly. Hello.
Hi.
Don't be frightened.
Hi, Anna.
It suddenly sort of seems real, doesn't it, when name is like...
Yeah.
It's almost like action.
Would you step forward, please?
Yeah.
Step onto
now
the line.
I'm a bit lightheaded.
Have you learned your lines? Are you off book?
Christ, I didn't realise there was...
No, because we sent you the script.
Yeah, of course, yeah. No, it's all up here.
That's right, good. As long as you're ready.
Oh, God, stop it now.
When you do auditions, are you off book? Do you learn like a prop, like an actor, or do you write on your hand?
Well, the thing these days is that you hardly ever go in for auditions, so you're always...
Are you doing the thing, weirdly, still called self-taping?
Self-taping, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I love it.
Is it fun?
I did one last night. And I did it, you know, head upwards, obviously.
Yeah.
Weird if it was head and below.
Your torso and not your face.
Yeah, I just did it in my dressing gown. Put some makeup on.
Right.
And printed out the lines, extra large, and sort of stuck them around the camera. And then just sort of, you read it, but it doesn't look like you're reading. Or there's teleprompter now, which is amazing. So you get the body of the script, and you put it into teleprompter, and it comes up like an auto cue.
That's what an app, is it?
What, on an iPad or something
like
that?
It's incredible, on an iPad.
Oh, what? Great.
I love self-tapes. Always get jobs from self-tapes, never in the room, because you have to be charming in the room.
It's a different job, I suppose.
Yeah, as the casting director has said recently to somebody that I've worked with, that they made the wrong choices when they were casting a first series of something, because they were giving the job to the person who they liked most, who came in the room, and actually on set it wasn't the person who could do the best job.
I suppose as well you've got that fantastic thing of what a camera does, and if someone's charming in the room, that might not transfer to the camera, whereas a self-tape is a merciless lens. Yeah,
this is what I am, this is what I can do.
Yeah.
And I don't have to do any of that awful sort of chatty stuff. Here I am, sat in a room with four people, some of whom won't even say hello or smile.
Yeah.
And I have to sort of come up with some hilarious anecdote just to kick off with, knowing full well that in a minute I've got to do the acting.
Who are the four people when you go into an audition?
So you might have a writer, but you'd have a producer, a director, and a casting director.
Right.
But normally it's people that you haven't met before.
Yeah.
And you can see in their eyes if they've already cast it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And you have to still be charming and bring out your anecdote.
You've got to try. I mean, I used to go in very... I thought I was probably like a breath of fresh air, but in hindsight...
You're a wet fart.
Anything but fresh air I was bringing to that room, where I'd go, I don't think I'm really right for this, guys.
It's a strange thing to do. It would be a strange thing to do if actors were naturally really tough and thick-skinned.
Yeah, but they're
and not. It's the opposite of that. It's to put yourself voluntarily up for the am I hot or not engine, basically.
Yeah, and now, because of the self-tape thing, you can look on Vimeo and you can watch the counts go up.
Oh, right.
So, so you can check back and see how many watches you've got, and that should be an indicator of how far down the line you're getting.
Oh, so it's like new face. It's like a clapometer.
That costs £5 a month.
For that torture.
And
this is awful. This is really awful.
So, this is like when I first found out about battery hens. Yeah. I'm going actor vegan.
Oh, yeah.
Anna, why are you doing this to yourself?
I don't know. Well, you've chosen to do this, so this is what you deserve.
Is it the end of the process? You haven't finished the process unless you found out how badly it's gone. Oh, oh. God. Anyway, how's life? Good?
Great.
Yeah. We were laughing just now because Jason had been going through his... You've been going through your archive boxes,
yeah,
haven't you?
My boxes are many, many boxes. And I found the original proposal document for what became yours and Katie Wicks' sketch show on Channel 4. And the front page of it had a picture of you two on it. And it said, "The Anna and Katie Show, so funny you'll think they're men." And I thought... We wouldn't do that now, would we?
No, we wouldn't. And funnily enough, it was it was the tagline on our poster for Edinburgh, the last Edinburgh that we did in 2009.
Wow.
And it felt like quite a brave thing to say.
Yeah.
The industry. And then I remember when our Channel 4 show was released in 2013, everyone was a bit more woke about that whole subject and, you know, men and women and comedy and all that. And I remember the exec, the lovely Neris at Channel 4, used it in a press release. So she said, "They're so funny, you'll think they're men." Because it was one of our lines.
Yeah.
And it was something that she and I and Katie had always laughed about. And people got really, "She can't say that. Can't say that." And then people took it the wrong way, because at that point, 2013, people were waking up.
It was in negotiation.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sort of like a joke about how women were not being allowed to have their voice in comedy. And we were talking earlier on about sort of still looking at cast lists and the only role for the woman being woman opposite.
Yeah.
Is that the role you got for a lot?
Yes, is woman one, woman opposite, woman. I did a thing a few years ago, and the character was somebody's mum. And rather than give her a name, they just continued all the way through, edited it, credits went up, still just called whatever the character's name was, mum.
Oh, my God.
And that's really depressing.
What that implies, well, because when you do a piece of writing, one of the last things you should always do, it's just a good habit, is go through and say, has anyone in this script not got any agency or identity? Because at some point you're going to be handing this script to an actor, and if you've not given Dan's mum enough thought to say she might be called Jenny, then when the actor says, "Hey, who is she?" you won't have the answer. So it's always good to go, well, even if she just knows she's called Judy, that's all. And then your brain might go, "Oh, then she's a typical Judy," and you might be able to actually answer the question. But
there's a lot to be said in a name. There's a lot just the simple act of giving somebody a name gives that character
a hook.
And Katie and I were very into that. I mean, stupid names were the thing that we spent the most amount of time on.
I was told off for that.
Fun. It's such fun to write silly names.
One of the first notes we ever got from a script editor is, "You're having too much fun doing the silly names." And we went, and we're trying to keep our interest up doing this job, so fuck off.
And it's the one thing, when you read something and you're going in for, say, a 40-year-old woman, and her name is Beryl, immediately for me I'm like, well, this isn't a funny script then, because nobody in their 40s is called Beryl. That's stupid.
Yeah.
But if her name is Jemima Sliptwat, then that's comedy.
We were told this by Andrew Ellard. We did a script, Andrew, who's a script editor, does Red Dwarf and a brilliant script editor, loads of Graham Linehan stuff and things, and Andrew's really good. And we had this script where a guy next door was called something like Roger, the neighbour, and he went, "For God's sake,
mistake. Yeah. If you're handing me a script and you call the neighbour Roger, you're missing the chance to call him Kramer or Niles.
Absolutely.
There's so many good names. And we eventually, because he was called Roger, called him Sloman.
Sloman.
After Roger Sloman, because we like Roger Sloman. He said, immediately, I know who that character is and the actor will be able to play them that way. But Sloman is a great name for a neighbour because it's Sloman, but it also has...
And he was eventually played by Simon Farnaby, who obviously you go, well, yeah, of course, that's Sloman, isn't it?
Only by deciding that the guy had to... That's part of it. It's just saying, in a while, an actor's going to have to think about this character. So can you do the honour of thinking about the character?
Absolutely, yeah.
So on names, we're going to be talking a little bit today about Peter Moorcross, aren't we? Moorcross. It's lovely, isn't it?
I like names like that. They're almost Dickensian names.
What's her name in it? I can't remember.
Flick.
Flick.
Oh, my
God.
So do tell the listening several what you've brought onto Rule of Three.
Listening several. Well, hardly anyone's ever heard of it or watched it. it's a show called Human Remains.
I don't want to know about evil, only want to know about love. I don't want to know about evil.
Coming as I do from a family of huge men, I mean, my father was medically a giant. And, I mean, Geoffrey was also wonderfully large. Which means that Peter falls really rather short.
We're looking for a riding outfit for my husband.
Right, the traditional sort
Please.
Of thing?
Ideally something he can grow into.
Okay, what size are you, sir?
I'm a 32-inch waist.
All right, well, let's try him in a 38.
I mean, if you want to try him in a size larger, perhaps we could try a 34?
34, darling.
Let's put him in a 36.
A 36 is fine.
It's on, I think, very early 2000s.
It's made in 2000. It's the same era as The Office.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it's around the same time as that.
And it is six standalone mockumentaries starring and written by Julia Davis and Rob Brydon. And I will say this up front. Firstly, I love the series. I absolutely love it. I loved it right from the off. I know it so well. I think it is the best thing Julia Davis has ever done.
I have to agree.
I think it's the best. I think the two of them together do that exponential thing where it's the pair of them are really good in things and this is them squared. Yeah. Mm. Together, this is the best thing.
They sort of, Rob Brydon, and it always surprises me when you see him, like I know he does The Trip now and he did Gavin and Stacey obviously, but the fact that he's now kind of the host, the comedy panel show host.
Yes.
He's so wasted. Like, he's an incredible performer.
He really is.
He really is a character.
Yeah.
And the way he slips into all those different characters, like the sort of the aggressive Welsh homophobic
thug. Yeah.
All over my glasses. Yeah. That one.
I've said it before. He's like the brother I never had. You know, I'm not saying I haven't got a brother because I have. But rightly or wrongly, he's more like a sister.
But this sort of terribly aristocratic thicko.
It's enormously thick.
It feels a bit like it's almost like, self-tape's the wrong word, it's almost like a demo, really. It's like when you get a keyboard and you press play and it does all the sounds.
Yeah.
This is six episodes in which you get all the different things. They're showing off their range in Alec Guinness, Kind Hearts and Coronets way of going. Yeah. But they do it's every class,
showreel.
Every dynamic. So one of them can be dominant, one of them can be sub-dominant. They can do clever, stupid, childlike, adult, boring, exciting. They do every single...
It's a perfect showreel. Like, you should never, ever... If you had that in your arsenal as a performer, you'd never worry about work ever again.
No.
Shay, we've had another...
I'm guessing it horse or very large dog.
Oh,
it's a wonderful one-off. It's six episodes long, and it's got that series of comic plays thing that now is on television again with Inside Number 9, where it's not a sitcom. So you can understand why you might not commission this again, because it's not got running characters. But it's got what Inside Number 9's got, which is you tune in every week because you want to see these people and their voice. You know these guys, and you trust them to be funny. So you'll watch them do anything.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about, love?
Taking my own life.
That's it. Now, do you know what I see out there? I see a boat. You know what I see on the boat? Me and you. Do you know what we're doing? We're cruising. Cruising together on the high seas. Having a lovely cruise. Eh? Now, you still feel like taking your own life?
Yeah.
That's it. Onward and upward. Together forever. Together when apart.
And I think it was so refreshing at the time because you'd seen kind of the Victoria Wood, the very big silly characters with the, you know, the silly voices.
Yeah.
This is silly voices, but it's about a millionth of the sort of the energy.
It's very, very subtle.
More like Victoria Wood would have put.
Well, but she did it. I mean, the two things it reminds me of, because it's a mock doc, but the two things that come before it that immediately it links to are Victoria Wood's documentary spoofs, like Swimming the Channel and A Very Ordinary Man or whatever. Those ones where Jim Broadbent's a boring man. It's very that. And it's very the day-to-day's documentary strands with No One Died and The Pool and The Office. The things they did in there, whether it's minutely observed.
In the day, all my hands up like that. I said, give them what they want, right? So, coffee, right? Sandwiches. Here we are.
I'm not ashamed to make a sandwich.
Situation being, ham, sausage, sausage, ham, jam. No lamb, can't shift it.
We don't tend to do your fancy sandwiches, you know, your brown beds and your bogles and whatnot. I mean, this isn't London.
And I've had the people, we've had them in here. You know, oh, you've got the order wrong, you know. Well, I'm sorry, I'm out of pocket, you know. I gave you what I heard. Gave you what I heard.
But it comes at a time of British fly-on-the-wall documentary making where everyone in comedy was really obsessed by Martin Parr documentaries and Lucy Blackstad documentaries and Molly Deneen, these documentary makers who would just train a camera on a couple until they revealed themselves or people who worked on a farm or whatever. Yeah. And Matt Lipsey, who directed this, directed Little Britain as well, and you know that Matt and David were obsessed by those things. Everyone seemed to be getting their comedy from watching fly-on-the-wall documentaries, which is what The Office is, and people like us. Where do you get your ideas from? Watching ordinary people be boring.
Well, I think, yeah, and because I was, oh, I don't know, in my teens when this was out.
Were you?
Roughly in my teens, Jason.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Give or take a few years.
Yeah, you were born when this was made, weren't you?
Yeah.
For your casting age, you were born to the sound of the theme of Human Remains.
Spiritually, you were a teenager, weren't you? I mean, that's what you were spiritually.
But I think, you know that thing when you're a kid and you watch your friends, parents, you have the sort of the circle of people that you can observe.
Yes.
Are your friends and their parents and teachers. And that's sort of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when you come across, because I had a friend whose parents were very into caravanning.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
And they had beige blinds and beige carpets and beige. But they were definitely sort of, they were racist. They were very homophobic. One worked in a bank. One did a lot of work with the church. And I remember I used to go to her house a lot. And she used to get a dustpan and brush after a barbecue and sweep the grass, the lawn, to get the crumbs up.
What?
It was so odd.
Oh, but perfectly formed comedy characters.
Perfectly formed comedy characters. And those were the people that you used to watch, I think, as a kid, teenager, and just be fascinated by this behaviour. There was another girl at school whose mum used to make sure that the kids didn't go into their bedrooms during the day at the weekends. She used to put a sprinkling of talcum powder around bedroom doors so that if they had gone into their rooms during the day, she knew. And those are sort of absolute batshit mental people that
You're right. As a kid, you watch the adult world through this same filter, which is, I was writing down saying, how does this work? Why are the jokes in this so funny? And they are tiny character sketches through which it's like you've twitched their curtains. It's a fly on the wall thing. Yeah. You peer in and go, it's like going, who are those? There's a couple in one of these who do look out the window at their neighbours convinced they're Satanists because they've got unusual garden furniture. But it's that thing of you, as a kid, you look and you go, you try and work out, almost triangulate, who are the next door neighbours by the tiny bits of evidence they leave out. It's like seeing, I don't know, looking at what's on someone's doormat or something.
Because you don't converse with those people.
Yeah.
As a kid, you don't have long chats, or you're not trying to sort of keep up appearances, or you're just silently watching them.
Yeah, everyone's a documentary crew as a kid, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's why I think Human Remains for me just felt like, I see where these people have come from.
These are grown-ups. This is the grown-up world.
And Julia and Rob are the kids silently observing them.
I think a husband is in many ways a little bit like having a pet. Certainly, Peter is that, in that he's always around and getting under my feet. And one sometimes wishes one could put them outside. one does have to keep up standards.
Yeah, well, they're sort of dressing up. I mean, they're at the age where, I mean, they can wear ball caps and they can age up to play these people. And there is a feeling of, like, mocking the grown-ups, mocking the people from the church hall, the church. group, or whatever.
Curly sausage.
There's a bit of that. I mean, a very, very Nuts in May, slightly Mike Leigh-y thing going on, but way more subtle, I'd argue, than a lot of what Mike Leigh does. They're very... Because the primary purpose is definitely comedy rather than anger. Mm. They're trying to make you laugh or make you unsettled or whatever. But what you're seeing through those glimpses of people is when they start out, what people say, what the grown-ups in these little dramas say, isn't what's going on behind closed doors. They'll be revealed to be sex people or possibly they killed their kids. Yeah. You think they've killed their kids in the episode where they're running the florists by the sea.
Yeah.
And there's a brilliant line there where the guy is so relentlessly optimistic and he says, "We're very happy apart from losing the twins." Which is, as a piece of
and
writing,
they talk about
that's amazing.
Services coming around quite a lot.
A lot of questions were asked.
And then, of course, they went.
A lot of questions were asked, and she's obviously been depressed since. It's full of these little lines where halfway through or 10 minutes in, where's the poison getting into this couple who are to the camera saying, "We're very, very happy. We're fine." And it'll go, "We lost the twins," or "Oh, this isn't my love," or "My first husband died," or "There'll be a," or "I've got a disease," or something. And there'll be a little drop of darkness, and you have to sort of, which is again like being a kid spotting.
Huge drop of darkness in most cases. It's so dark. But you never, because I absolutely love that sort of stuff. And having done quite dark comedy live, I know how brave it is to put lines in like that because people will hate you.
Yeah.
If it goes badly, if they're not quite on side or that bad thing that you're mentioning has happened to somebody that they know, or you've had it. Oh no, we're walking out. Come on, Margaret, we're going.
Yeah. So it's very easy to lose people.
Easy to lose people. And in a live setting, you might have some walkouts, all the better for it, I say. But if you're putting that out on BBC, you know, you could really bury yourself if you get the tone of that wrong. But somehow, even though it is that dark, it's never cynical.
This comes out very, very soon after Alan Partridge, within sort of a few years of that, which I think for the BBC was the biggest they'd ever taken a character who'd been quite broad and jolly and said, okay, I'm Alan Partridge, Linton Travel Tavern. There's just darkness visible constantly through lines. This is made by Baby Cow, isn't it? By Steve Coogan,
yes,
Henry Normal, that same team. They've had a success with Partridge and they've sort of said, well, the public seem to be able to still love and take a character when you peel away the face and see the horrible, I mean, the one-sided phone conversations Partridge has with his wife and his son are very human remains, very, you read in the unsaids.
Look, your mum and I, believe me, your mum, we did it everywhere. We, you know, in the lounge, in the hall, behind a large boulder on Hell Valin for my birthday. Actually, that is where you were conceived. We just didn't take precautions.
And Human Remains is all about those unsaids, the horribleness behind the bluster of saying we're very happy. Because it's about couples and relationships.
But it's a big risk, because if you've got the one character that's been phenomenally successful, like Alan Partridge, you can look at him because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
And you can go, well, he's just an idiot and we know him, so that's fine. But to take half hour brand new sets of characters and be as brave with some of those jokes as that, I mean, there's one episode that, like we said, we wouldn't talk about because it's essentially, it's bullying someone with learning difficulties.
Yeah.
I mean, rightly or wrongly, I like it. No? You like it now? Shall? You like it now? Hey? Spindolero say yes. Hey, champion of the world. Spindolero. Don't hit me. Boom, boom, boom. Don't hit me. Spindolero, I arrest you on a charge of self-abuse.
Increasingly, this will become an area we need to talk about, which is the documentaries from which these are inspired very often had or focused on people with learning difficulties, with issues like that. And I think we've changed our standards with documentary making. Oddly, John's Not Mad, that kind of thing.
Ross.
Yeah, but oddly, that's the first one of those that everyone went mad for, because that style of documentary making where you went, well, you're not saying there's a mental health issue here. Those people now go on to Britain's Got Talent. Weirdly, the reality and constructive reality is where those slightly exploitational Susan Boyle, those kind of things where someone is very vulnerable, they are now championed on reality shows and competitions. Whereas back in the day, around the 90s, 2000s, there were a lot of documentaries about things like Mike Reed's Stalker, which became very, very...
I didn't see that.
Oh, Blue Tulip Rose Reed.
That's the one that constantly appears on...
League of Gentlemen make references
League
to
of Gentlemen
it.
On I know, newspaper boards. And
yeah, I know Little Britain, the guys were interested. They sort of passed as sort of contraband things. There's an astonishing person on television. But what you didn't say is a film crew has exploited some with mental health issues, which I think you'd think now. But there was... It was very much the lingua franca of those documentaries was very often they went for people who are vulnerable and stood back. You're taking people who are very low status and putting them on television. Even, I imagine, Maureen from Driving School, those characters who became celebrities who weren't ready for it, those proto-Susan Boyles, that was in the culture. And these
it's
comedy shows...
a lack of responsibility towards those people that I feel that we have much more of.
Totally. Them. I think they've given more, but I think weirdly the comedy that came out of it now, you look at it and you go, oh, you bristle, and you think, no, this was, television was very like this at the time. And in that one, which is all over my glasses, where Julia Davis is playing her jam character, the I do know what a parking meters are character, that very, very slack, low energy performance.
Not pregnant as such, but, you know, could happen at any time. Stephen's got quite a temper.
In that, your sympathy's entirely with her, and it's her yobbish, thuggish boyfriend who's the person who gets the most savagery. So I think it walks a difficult line.
That one in particular, I mean, it's...
Annoyingly, I think it's the funniest one
it
of the lot. Because I think the performances are committed and the depth of characterisation in that, I'd never seen anything like that. And it did look like there's a responsibility to it, I think, in that it's depicting something that definitely exists in the world, those couples, people with that relationship, that incredible, what's effectively domestic abuse, gaslighting, and that's brave comedy. But my God, it's hard to watch.
It is, but it's very funny.
I remember showing it to my mum and dad. My mum and dad liked The Office, and I said, oh, you'll love this, and I showed them that episode of Humour Remains. They didn't laugh.
No. The thing is that, like, problematic is not the opposite of funny, right? Nor is offensive the opposite of funny. Something can be offensive and funny.
Yeah.
It can be problematic and funny. Those things can coexist together, and it does in that episode, I think. It wasn't very problematic at the time. It's becoming problematic now, and it's going to get more problematic.
You can say that about it would be hard to watch if you had someone in your family with anger issues. They might find it hard to watch Basil Fawlty. I know plenty of dads I know didn't enjoy watching Basil Fawlty this year.
To me though, lads, and I'm sorry to say this, I was never a comedy geek. I didn't get into comedy until 2004, I think.
Right.
And I never used to watch comedy, and I was never the girl that would turn up and see live comedy all the time and, you know, look at things and pick things apart. And so for me, I was simply laughing at the fact that she had really thick glasses on.
She's a very, very regal woman. When she was young, of course. Actually wasn't sure I could see a look of a young sort of Susan Hampshire about her. But now she's grown, she's matured into something very regal, with more than a passing resemblance to Camilla Parker Bowles. Lucky old Peter.
The episode we've all had a good deep dive into is the first episode, An English Squeak.
An English Squeak, yes.
And this is about Peter and Flick. Who are a married couple. This is Flick's second marriage.
She wasn't married to Jeffrey, was she? They were in their 20s when he died.
That's right. Mm. And he was her soulmate, and he was medically a giant.
Her father was medically a giant.
Both of them. Her father was medically a giant.
He was very large.
With a very small head. In proportion to his body.
He was killed in a boating accident.
That's right. He was pulled down by the reeds, wasn't he?
But Peter... had tried to save the wrong person.
Yes.
Had given a sunbathe a mouth-to-mouth. And in the meantime, Jeffrey had died.
And within a day, Peter has proposed to Flick.
Within an hour of getting back to the police station. Amazing.
Which is, again, there's a lovely subtext of that. There's a college. They were at college at Cambridge together. Okay. It's a lovely thing.
The dot, dot, dot between Cambridge and university.
Yeah.
Just trying to clarify that.
Well, we met at Cambridge.
University. We originally met in drama soc.
Hmm.
Hither and yon, you know, neither of us had done a great deal in that department. But, I mean, Flick made us super Miss Julie.
Oh, I've always been a bit of a clown.
the hidden story of a college romance where Peter was waiting in the wings like some dutiful dog, waiting for a gap where he could go and marry Flicker, was a great beauty.
Oh, it's she had a look of Susan Hampshire
and a Camilla Parker Bowles. It's all the class notes and all the furniture around it is absolutely perfect. And it's probably worth talking about how this series was made, because it's written in a really interesting way. What it is, it's the ultimate actor showcase, as we've said, but also it's an amazing writing showcase. And how it was made is they improvised, they worked out the characters and the dynamics, and then improvised into portable handy cameras in their flat. And there's that footage available on the DVD. You can flick and actually watch the...
Yeah, the DVD, we must say, is a really good package.
It's brilliant. You can watch them in the flat in parallel with the scenes doing it. But what it means is they've improvised, and then instead of doing the improvisation to camera in the final take like you would do in a Will Ferrell movie, they've just learned the improvisation. So they've just sifted out the best 20 lines from an hour and are then performing them, but with the feeling that they're coming up with them on the cuff, which I think is how Christopher Guest does a lot of the stuff in Spinal Tap and his movies. It's a really great way of making very natural sounding comedy, but it's also a way of sifting out what are the best jokes.
I'd never known sex like it. For me, sex had always been perfunctory.
It was like jumping off a diving board
into a bouncy castle.
When you watch the footage of them on the handycam, all you can see is the two of them holding in waves of laughter, of Julia Davis just cracking up and throwing her head back.
There's quite a lot of scenes in the later episodes. They're obviously on their best behaviour in an English Squeak, but you can see she'll make a character choice to rub his back so she can move her head behind his head.
She's got a lot of long hair sometimes, which is in front of her face, or she's
worked. I don't know how
that's very well spotted.
Incredible.
But when you watch the roughs of it, they're working this stuff out, and they're doing it to make each other laugh. So when he says Susan Hampshire, you know that in the flat when they work out, that was the name of maybe three that he chose that got the big laugh off his partner. And what the whole show feels like, even though they're not necessarily love letters to the characters, they may even despise the characters, they really love each other. They really love making each other laugh. And I think it's all about couples and all about dynamics. And the dynamic that is on the screen throughout that makes it watchable is it's always Rob Brydon and Julia Davis. And you can tell they're just loving making each other laugh.
Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think the first 10 minutes of An English Squeak is, I think there's a joke every 30 seconds.
It's
maybe?
Fast, isn't
it? It's really fast. It's so impressive.
They're not indulgent. I mean, this should be an actor's indulgence, and it's far from that.
Jokes after joke after joke. So jealous.
Great great surrounding cast as well. You know, Nana is played by
Joanna Scanlon.
And Stephen Mangan does a turn
as a birthday clown.
Children's entertainer. Yeah.
Well, there's a slight implication in this that Peter is basically a child. And he's sort of very, very articulate, like anyone who's been to a good school. He can explain himself. But obviously he's on a swing a lot. And he's filmed like a little boy. And he's taking part in a Gymkhana where everyone else is about eight.
Yeah, and he's on this fucking enormous horse. It's like 16 hands or something. Yeah. This horse is huge.
He says at one point, when he's talking about the job that he does, he's in corporate hospitality or something, and he says,
I make a noise in hospitality. Corporate hospitality. Mostly making a noise on the telephone. I can't pretend it's difficult work. But I find it very hard.
So he is.
So it's there's a power
and
dynamic.
Of course, the other thing about his childishness is that he's got his comforter, hasn't he?
It'll cushion.
Because he spends a lot of the time with a cushion over his lap. And as you pointed out earlier, that's obviously something that they just had lying around the flat when they were improvising it, and it becomes a character note.
Yeah.
He takes it off his lap at one point and then says, but I do prefer it with it on, and puts it back on his lap.
And there's the implication that he's in a lot of these where he's burying basically his crotch because, of course, Flick suffers terribly. She's very tight. Flick suffers from almost fatal, she claims, vaginismus.
Yes.
So get the feeling that there's always in these characters an underbed of sex that is being pushed down in that brutish way.
People ask, is it infertility? No, it's not.
It's not.
It's rather more delicate, rather more private, and it's not something.
It's vaginismus.
That's right.
During intercourse, the vaginal walls contract to the point where penile accommodation is absolutely impossible.
Even a small penis feels like an aubergine.
Yeah. And this couple, I think, almost the best one. It's almost the best depiction of it. There's a lovely one where they've got swingers in who are very open about sex.
Yeah, I can't watch that. That's too rude.
Is it just too saucy?
Slytherin. They're Brummies, aren't they?
Yeah, yes, Brummy sex right. People yeah. with
the, oh, look. There is a dynamite outtake from that one on the DVD is as there? Well. Yeah.
Oh, speaking of climaxes, thank you very much for last night.
My pleasure.
Oh, dear. It's like a lawnmower.
There's one dirty Lynn there, sex people one, which is, you're right, it's awkwardly rude. But what's great about the rest of them, and obviously Julia Davis has done loads of stuff where she's played with sex and embarrassment in her work since then, and I find some of that too rude as well. What I love about these is because it's repressed, they're very watchable, because it's the same repressed sexuality that's in George and Mildred. It's a very good repressed British sitcom sexuality, yet they talk about sex all the time. There's always, the camera's always catching antics through windows and things.
And noises as well. They're big into their sex noises. It's often a scene, though, they'll just cut away from, you know, humping noises. I remember buying this because I was so obsessed with this when it came out. And I went out and I think I bought everyone for Christmas and birthday for about 2 years a copy of Human Remains.
Oh, great.
Well, you will like it because it's the best thing that's ever been on TV, and hardly anyone ever liked it.
Really?
No.
I found it, I got a really good hit rate with making people watch it. Watching it again at home, I went, oh God, I remember the year where this is all I did. Was someone come around and went, we're putting this on. Yeah. Like the day to day, anyone who came into the house had to watch Slytherin, All Over My Glasses, and
I
Squeak.
I would judge friends on whether or not we had a future as to whether they liked Human Remains or not, I think, for a while. I bought my brother a copy, and I think he was like, he wanted to enjoy it because he could see that I really loved it, but he admitted, oh, I'm not sure that I'm really that into it after all. I felt crushing disappointment when people didn't like it. So I was like, this is the best thing that's ever been on TV.
But there's a truth about this, which is probably worth talking about generally, I mean, on this podcast, which is that comedy is so niche. The best comedy, the stuff that goes in deep, that belongs to you, very often your best friend might not like it, or someone who you've shared, your sibling might not like it. You can have everything in common with someone apart from the precision of their sense of humour, whereas you will broadly agree that that was an exciting drama or a good film. Comedy is so specific, and the hardest thing with making comedy is putting it on broadcasting networks where everyone goes, well, 22 million people didn't watch it, it's a failure. But whereas actually the best comedy is stuff that speaks directly to you. Funny bone.
And I started off doing stand-up, and it was very niche, my act.
Was
niche.
It? How niche? Can you describe it?
Did you like it? Did you not like it?
I loved it.
Oh, it was just for you.
Most people hated it. I did stuff about having a partner who had no foot, and so we couldn't go back to the farm because of the cattle rails. I did an impression of a jellyfish who ate particles off the ocean floor.
Sort of a Peter Kay kind of a broadly observational
like
routine.
McIntyre,
that kind of area, yeah.
And I used to be sort of punted because I had a full-time job in casting, and I would miss my lunch hour from work so I could finish at 5 so I could get on a train and go to Lancashire to do this stuff about jellyfish and a man with no foot to like 200 students. And they'd just be like, oh, they were furious.
Did you like that?
So angry.
Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it to begin with. And then after a while, I was like, why am I missing my lunch hour and getting home at 2 in the morning to then get up again at 7 in the morning to go back to work to have angry students shouting and hurling things at me? Ultimately, if I didn't split a room, I came away disappointed.
Is that one when you teamed up with Katie? I couldn't believe when I first saw your show with Katie, the first Penny Pub show, I thought you'd known each other since childhood or something, because it was a completely shared voice and it had that same sense of secret delight that you get from Human Remains. You're watching two people who make each other laugh so much that the gift as an audience is being allowed into that two-person gang.
Yeah. No, we worked together for... God, we got together. We saw each other at a gig, at a competition gig, and my stomach hurt from laughing watching Katie's act. And she, the same with me, and no one else in the room was laughing. So we thought, do you know what we need to do? Definitely, like, get together.
At least there's an audience of one in every single room who will be laughing.
And so we continued to split audiences for many Edinburghs. but there's always the thing of... I remember the first year we were in Edinburgh, we ended up getting, like, these incredible reviews. And I think the Times or someone like that had given us 5 stars. So immediately you're selling out, like, it's 50-seater, this tiny little room. But you're selling out to a group of soon-to-be very angry Times readers. And I think my mum heard somebody as she was leaving the venue one day going, what cunt gave that 5 stars?
That should go on the poster for next year.
So it's that you can do this sort of off-kilter stuff, but if you get the wrong audience, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought that a good review could actually work against your favour?
It totally did. But it really did.
You don't want to raise expectations. Well, again, it's why there's still an art to who you recommend things to. What scheduling is on television is basically the recommendation of a trusted friend. This doesn't feel like a BBC One show. This feels like I'm used to Mrs. Brown's Boys. What's Alan Partridge doing on there? That you're always at that risk. And I suppose what you've got with Human Remains is something which you're passing round from person to person, saying, please be like me.
It's the darkest thing you'll ever see.
Well, the bit in An English Squeak where at the beginning Flick refers to Peter, he's more like a pet, really. You want to keep him outside, but you mustn't. And then later on, when she's talking about where he will be buried, and she's got the grave of Geoffrey in the grounds of the manor,
curled around him like
she'll
a
be
banana.
Curled around.
And Peter's saying, well, I'll be next to her. She's no, you'll be over there, and points towards the pet cemetery, and he'll be with the dogs and the hamster over there.
I mean, I always knew with Geoffrey that he was very much the one. These wonderfully large, very red lips, quite bulbous, I think one would almost say, particularly a big tongue. I mean, he was medically a giant. And I'll never forget how it used to probe into my mouth and really search my mouth. You know, one would feel that it was actually quite forceful.
Well, I mean, Geoffrey really was rather good at everything that he did. I mean, that was the thing about him, is that he was an achiever and he was captain at all sorts of sports. And I suppose kissing was no different. I mean, I never experienced the kiss myself. Flick! Oh, dear. The vaginismus. Sometimes when the muscles contract, Flick will get depleted, the blood sugar will go down. It's a form of diabetes, isn't it, darling? It's all right. There, come on, I've got
you. Please don't pour me, darling.
It's all right.
Please don't pour me, darling. Thank you.
And she's treated, it's pure abuse. And she's wondering, but she's always got an eye patch on or a crutch as her way of saying, I'm too ill to pay attention to you or to your needs.
He does this whole thing at the end of that episode where he's talking about her vaginismus and how hopefully, you know, one day he will have his meal again, i.e. have sex with her again. And so he doesn't want to snack because he's just building up to this moment when they can finally have sex again. Vaginismus is cleared up. And then she says something like, of course, best case scenario is it can just be a slow, steady decline until there is no penile accommodation at all. Or something like that. And it goes back to his face and he's just like, oh, right, this is our life then.
If you couple the grief with a very, very tight, you know, there's not much room for Peter.
They do this wonderful thing, which again doesn't happen very often in improvised stuff, because very often if you've got stuff that's purely improvised to camera, they're often one-shot, counter-shot, one-shot, counter-shot. The joy of watching people who know each other is the two-shot. And this, 'cause it's about couples, it's all shot in two shots. So when someone's doing their grandstanding turn, you've got the other face to watch, which tells you the rest of the story. So when she's talking to camera, you get Rob Brydon's sort of little boy disappointed face. And they do so much of that. And when you see, again, the original rehearsals, the person who's reacting is just laughing.
Right.
But when they remove the laughter and go, okay, how would I react to someone saying, I'm hoping I eventually become so tight he can't get in me at all and eventually hopefully we'll just die or he'll die. The look on the other character's face is where the rest of the story is.
Yeah, and that character is still trying to slightly hold it together
on camera.
That's the perfect storm, isn't it?
It's brilliant. They don't put the documentary crew are not visible. Which is quite nice. They don't do a sort of David Lander or a People Like Us. They don't have jokes about documentary form, but they're really strict about only showing you what would be in one of these documentaries, because I know Jason and I are sticklers for this. We hate it when something looks like a mock doc, but they put bits in it that you wouldn't film.
Yeah.
This is really good at looking like a Molly Deneen or a Lucy Blackstad.
Yeah.
It's really strict. They said, it's a mock doc and we're following those rules, which is very flattering to the audience. You are invited to be the fly on the wall. You're the camera.
There's loads of those examples where you could, you know, the camera has followed somebody into a room where it wouldn't, and
they
picked up on a conversation that you would, if you had a camera crew in your house, you would never allow
that
to happen. That's when the sort of
the reality
the illusion
breaks
is broken.
But this is very good at any time something private's happening, it's shot sneakily through door jams and they're tiny glimpses of people who are doing something that they've said they don't do on camera. The camera crew have stolen it, which makes it much funnier. It's just a class act. It's really good.
There's a lovely bit at his party where
there's a fucking 8-year-old's birthday party.
It was literally the clown.
Balloons.
A dog cake. A horse cake.
Lovely line from the clown as well. Shall I make Peter disappear?
Peter's grandfather died in his mid-40s and his father died in his early 40s. So we can only keep our fingers crossed.
Shall I make Peter disappear?
Yes.
Shall I make him disappear? Go away, Peter! Go away! Go away! He's gone!
And off he goes. But there's a beautiful moment where she's playing the piano rather well, and he's like sort of
singing
trying to sort of harmonise with it.
Yeah. Oh, it's
but there's a woman right at the back of shot, just an essay, a supporting artist.
Yeah.
And she's eating some cake, and you can just hear the chink of her spoon on the plate, because she's just carry on eating. It's really.
And then he turns, it's the back of his head, and he turns to camera, and he's had face paint put on, so he looks like a tiger or something. Oh God, magical.
Love it.
It's lovely that none of the characters in this is getting what they want, are they?
Yeah.
I mean, Flick is unhappy, Peter's unhappy, Peter can't have sex with this beautiful woman that he loves. Meanwhile, Nana would fuck the living daylights out of Peter given half a chance, and he won't.
On at the end.
Joe Scannon jumping on top of Rob Brydon is delightful.
Which almost feels like a moment of victory. You go, hooray! He's having some, oh God, this is bleak, but they're keeping these tiny victories, but no one's getting what they want.
Flick tries to fuck the clown, doesn't she?
And
he won't have it.
He's
terrified.
Is that brilliant thing? Just you see the huge clown shoes at the end of the bed is how it's done, which is, I mean, it's a carry on of a gag, but they fit in this world. And a couple of the couples in this series, they use the phrase, well, all we have is each other. And it's all about people who go, all we have each other. And you want to go, that's not enough. You've got to stop. They're all about codependency. And that's a lovely thing to do with a double act.
Yeah.
Because codependency is what Eric and Ernie have got. It's what all double acts have. You're not the same without the other person. But these are really broken double acts. So there's comedy in the dynamic between them, but it's a horrible, bleak, desperate need for each other.
Yeah.
The happiest man in the world, the happiest man in the world, and you're the happiest girl, you're the happiest girl, and I'm the happiest man in the world.
The darkness, though, is, I think, always has appealed to me. The darker it can go, the better. Because it's not, you know, it's not something that you see on TV, so it seems like you're a bit naughty watching it somehow.
Yeah.
Like, this shouldn't be allowed. Great. Let's get stuck in.
Tonally, the whole series is pretty good because it keeps, though the darkness is very dark, it's not in the foreground usually.
No.
It's kept very well controlled. So
they're hiding
the
it.
Funny is in the foreground and the darkness is sitting back there somewhere and you are definitely aware of it.
But that's in the form. That was always when you went to the playground after you'd watched one of these documentaries. Imagine you watch a Louis Theroux documentary or whatever, all these things that were around roughly at this time, and you'd in the playground or in the office the next day, you'd say, did you see that thing? God, that guy was mental. I bet he had his dead mum upstairs. There was always that thing that you said.
I can't
said.
Imagine which Louis Theroux you're talking about.
I don't know. there was that bit, Louis Theroux always went, can I see you in the bedroom to people? And he went, oh, that's where the secret is. And you're always in these things doing the psycho thing of what's in the fruit cellar.
Yeah.
What's down there? What's buried? Yeah. What aren't they saying to camera is inherent in the form. Because it's why I think comedians and people who like comedy watched those documentaries at the time, because there was always a hidden thing. And that's where you found the joke.
When Flick is feeling particularly tired and tight, I will sleep in my study. And Nana creeps up with a little nightcap for me, and there'll be a tenderness in her eyes, and I'm at once transported back to childhood.
It's very quotable, isn't it? It's a very quotable series.
Incredibly quotable.
Because they've worked it, they've practiced it, and these are their favourite lines they're doing.
Yeah,
for
that's
the,
true.
The
that's true.
Can, yeah,
of course.
Sometimes you can almost see the glee in their eyes when they're like, oh, I'm so glad this got in, this line.
Oh, you can see as well sometimes when they've done it, I do a short line where there's loads of joke hidden in the line, that you can see them hoping that someone says, and stop, because they're going to crack up. They've got the quickest possible distance to get all the story and joke in. But if you like Alan Partridge and you like the day-to-day and those no one died bits and the I've bought some tungsten tipped screws, the banal jokes that are in Victoria Wood as well, if they tickle you, Alan Bennett, if that makes you laugh, then this is exactly in that key.
Yeah.
Doritos, posh crisps.
Spindler, or Magnifico.
Oh, yeah.
So your thing is that Van Damme, he wears lifts. Is that brilliant thing? He's where the yobbish Welsh guys naming actors who are also short, and she joins in.
I mean, you look at any of these Hollywood stars and they all wear boots. Sylvester Stallone, Billy Joel, he's not big, he wears boots.
Tom Cruise,
he wears them.
Father Christmas.
Michael Douglas with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
She's Welsh. Well, she thinks Father Christmas is an American action star. It's thrown away and swallowed. That might be my favourite line from the whole series.
Even in an English squeak, little phrases like hither and yon.
Mm.
I heard that and went, oh, God, that's good. That's
actually,
such good
writing. That's pure Christopher Guest. The reason you laugh at Spinal Tap is the characters are nice and it's generous, but you're laughing at the phrasing. And they've got the phrasing right. They've practiced this. They're good at talking to each other, and they've written their 20 favourite jokes down.
She's moved Jeffrey's body, hasn't she?
Yeah.
In his burial plot, so that he's now erect.
Buried upright.
So perfect. Why? For no reason.
She's going to be curled round him, isn't she?
Like a banana, because that was their favourite position.
Yes.
Oh,
so
my God.
They're recreating their favourite sex position for the grave. Peter's not allowed in.
They change from show to show, which I think helps as well when you're talking about sort of what these are difficult dynamics. But sometimes he's alpha, sometimes she's alpha. It's about couples, and because it's about couples and relationships, it's about dynamics. So it's pure comedy, as in there's a high status clown and a low status clown in each of the relationships, and they both enjoy playing both. It's lovely. This is a good one, I think, this one, because Julia Davis
is high status
and being very aristocratic, and he's this little bullied man.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of them, he's sort of this relentlessly chipper or yobbish guy.
Mm. In other episodes, they do have a lot of recurring stuff where he is aggressive but friendly.
But also, they play with that kind of everyone's stupid. Everyone can't see that everyone can see what's going on. Everyone's a bit stupid. So sometimes you're just laughing at them because they're proper clowns. There's a brilliant thing where they're putting up the wallpaper in the nursery with the little bears doing somersaults.
God, they're stapling and she's, it.
And they're stapling the wallpaper to the wall. But they're obsessed by the fact that some of the bears have been printed upside down by mistakes. So they're cutting them out and turning them over, ruining it. It's jokes like that, but the characters can't see how stupid they are. And they can't see that you can see through it. So when they're doing the thing with Les, the guy who's constantly singing, he's running the florists, that his little songs, his annoying little songs he's improvising, that he thinks that's covering up for the despair at the heart of their life. And they're all doing that. All the characters are sort of going to camera. It's kind of a keep calm and carry on mentality. It's very British and very wrong.
Yeah. I think in All Over My Glasses, there's a moment where they're forcing her on her hen night to recreate the pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, it's abuse. Why is it funny?
Well, they like the joke.
Is that us? Is that?
I don't know. I think what you're watching is you're watching people lying, because there's something always really funny when someone in a farce or whatever says, "Of course I wasn't." You're laughing because you know they were, and so they're all saying, "We've got a very functional relationship. We're very happy. We're very happily married. We need each other," to the camera. And what you're laughing at is that they're lying, because you can see layers of this. There's a great line in An English Squeak where Flick's talking about her time at Rodine.
I was the same at Rodine. I was pretty popular. I mean, a little bit of bullying went on, but I don't regret it.
Which
is amazing.
I mean, as a piece of writing, is amazing. You flip it over, but what you're saying there is there's a history of bullying and abuse.
Yeah,
there are secret victims buried everywhere in all their backstories.
But I think it's a testament to their performance and the standard of writing that you feel completely comfortable.
Yes.
You feel completely at ease with this. You're like, this isn't going to tip over into anything that I'm going to...
If these guys are okay about it, I think there's, again, we're back in that thing of saying you're watching different characters every time, but you're watching Rob Brydon and Julia Davis.
Yeah.
And the vibe...
The confidence you feel in what they're doing is that, I'm in your hands. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. And that's the art. That's the real art of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, you know, if your audience doesn't feel... like they're completely safe within your hands, they won't go with the dark stuff.
Yeah.
They just won't allow you to go there.
Obviously, they've got that in common with people like the League of Gentlemen, who are working a very similar kind of thing, where you go, well, I mean, it'll be dark, but I trust these guys to take me there because I like those guys. They're pretty making themselves laugh. So you can't say there's no comedy in it. And you know the intent is all delight. They're not just trying to upset you. And it's a bit like getting on a roller coaster or something. You want to be a bit thrilled and feel a bit like, whoa.
Some people don't. There's a brilliant, the Dutch Elm Conservatoire, which is Dan Skinner and Rufus Jones and...
Jim Phil Smith.
Jim Phil Smith and Steve Evans and Jordan.
And there's a great anecdote they used to tell. Are they doing, I think, their biggest sort of Edinburgh audience yet in a big venue. And it's all about escaped prisoners, I think. But they've got spent loads of money on like searchlights and sort of dry ice and sirens going off. And this is going to open their show. And one of them said, just from the wings, they heard someone in the front go, and it's dramatic and it's all building.
Yeah.
And someone in the front row just said, oh no, I've got a bad feeling about this. and it's the idea that someone could just go, no, this is going to be really bad.
That sort of audience vaginismus can't happen at the beginning. They can't tighten up at the beginning.
There's no accommodation allowed.
Peter's concerned that I shan't cope when he goes, but... I've told him not to worry.
I think maybe that's why we regard this so highly, is you've got a thing here which you're playing with. There's a bunch of dangerous stuff in there, which they're playing with. You're playing with dark themes and you're playing with improvisation, which can go wrong. It's an actor's vanity project, which can go wrong.
Yeah.
All this stuff can go wrong. But the reason you watch it and enjoy it, and the moment it starts, you go, we're in safe hands, is that these two are brilliant at it. They're evidently brilliant at it, and you trust them to take you in it, and you trust them not to waste your time.
Do you think that you would feel like that if you watched it fresh for the first time now, 20 years into your career?
Yes.
Do you?
Yeah,
I do.
Because I'm not sure how I would feel.
I don't know. I think
at the time I didn't do comedy. I had a 9-to-5 and, just thought this was the greatest thing ever. But I wonder But I can watch it now and enjoy it as much as I ever did. And you can't say that about a lot of things.
Yeah. It's dated very well, I think. In terms of the jokes are still really, really
Absolutely.
Funny.
The jokes are still there.
But it's just very beautifully made as well. I hadn't thought about the stakes that you were just talking about, but the stakes for this were very high, aren't they? You've got improvisation, you've got Vanity Project, you've got a great director, Matt Lipsey. And it looks brilliant. Yeah. It's really beautifully shot, even though on the commentary, Rob Brydon talks about how a lot of An English Squeak was shot on the last day because they felt they were light on material. So, fun is that you can't tell that at all. It looks beautifully worked out.
Yeah. And it's also shot in the summer as well.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't know why that makes a difference.
It stops it being too dark.
You see them swimming in a pool.
Yeah. It's got no claustrophobia. It's got a very, very big sky. The lovely one with where they're running the terrible florists in Brighton.
Mm.
Those huge bright skies
you can
and things.
See that it's just sat outside in the warm sunshine. They're not pretending that they're warm, which is
Yeah.
I mean, it's all there, isn't it? That's idealism for me. You see, I mean, I said it before. Well, people say the cruel sea, you know, but I don't go along with that. I say it's beautiful. I'll say there's only one thing more beautiful, and that's Ray.
We've done stuff in the past that you can see my lips are turning blue on the monitor. And
sucking an ice cube to stop your breath freezing.
Yeah, it's hard to watch that stuff.
I suppose what it looks like is it looks like the best time of their lives. It looks like they are having the best. And Brydon's talked about it. He's talked about it. He said, I'd go back at a heartbeat. You see, sometimes apparently phones Julia Davis and says, God, you see that couple on television. They'd be a perfect human remains couple. They've still got it in their heads. And it looks like, but weirdly, this part of the character work and the fact that the people in it are having a horrible time feels like the characters are having a horrible time. But this is a delightfully welcoming darkness to it because I think that the pair of them are clearly having a hoot.
Yeah, that must have been, for those two and everybody else on the crew, that must have been one fucking glorious summer, mustn't it?
I
imagine how much fun this was to make. Oh.
And just, lunch hours, sat outside, enjoying the sun.
Making up new stuff, making each other laugh.
Yeah, like what an idyllic summer that would have been.
You just know that at some point Julia Davis just arrived with an eye patch on. It's never explained.
She suddenly decided that the fashionist was just making her blind in one eye.
She does say sporadic blindness.
But it's clearly, turned up. It's got that. What's amazing is that we're coming, I didn't know we'd end up here, but we're talking about something which has got a reputation for being one of the darkest things ever. The thing that was the springboard for Nighty Night and Underby and camping and all this darkness. And we're just saying, God, what a lovely place to go.
Yeah.
And maybe that's it. Maybe in its DNA is how much fun they had. And again, if you get the DVD, flick on the buttons to see them rehearsing it and working out what they're going to say. And all you can see is two people crying, laughing. And it's a strange part of comedy, I suppose, that when you're making dark stuff, probably because it's naughty, you're laughing harder than you ever would do. Again, it's laughing at a funeral. You're not meant to laugh at this stuff.
But everyone knows, I mean, particularly sketch acts, the stuff that made you laugh most in when you were writing it is always the stuff that goes down better.
Yeah.
Even if it's not the most palatable, the joy of it is infectious. Mm. You wonder how many of these people they'd met. Don't you?
I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder whether any of them were based on real people.
It's got to be maybe an acorn of...
I've got a friend like that, or my mum's mate.
Yeah.
It feels real, but definitely the two people you can see all the way through it are the two of them. They're never invisible. And that's probably what's the most joyous thing about it, is that you want to spend time with those guys.
Oh, do a second series, Julia and Rob.
Yeah.
Do more.
You want to have another glorious summer. One more glorious summer.
And it would have to be shot in the summer.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing in and celebrating the sunny delights of human remains. Definitely British comedy's most sunshiny show.
Bring me sunshine.
In your smile.
Anna Crilly, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Hands up who's got wood. Late. Hands up who's got wood.